So I read this week about, I read an article. It was titled 25 Weirdest Wedding Proposals of All Time. So I got a couple for you. Are you ready? I like this one. This is from Pong Kun, and he had 48 people dress up as carrots, and they danced the routine in front of the girlfriend, and then he whipped off his carrot costume and proposed to her. Isn't that romantic? Oh, hold on. I need to wipe the tears out of my eyes here. This next one, a little scary here. This is Russian Alexei Bykov, and he hired a film director and stuntman to fake his own death. He died in front of his girlfriend, and then when she came to see this dead boyfriend of hers, he rose again in front of her and proposed to her. A little weird. This next one is Matt Still. He sent his girlfriend to the movies. And then when a movie came on, it turned out that the movie was of her was the boyfriend, and it was of the boyfriend going to her dad and asking for permission to propose to the girl. And he said yes. And then he ran into the movie theater and proposed to her. That's a pretty good one. And his last one here. This is Lawrence Key. He went on a roller coaster with his girlfriend. And then he held up the signs. You know, if you've been on roller coasters, they take a picture of you and try to sell it to you after. So he had some of his friends hold up the "Will you marry me" signs. There he is with the "me" part. But she's in the front, so she doesn't see it. So they get to the souvenir stand after and look at the picture. And he proposes to her right there at the amusement park. I'm assuming she said yes, because I know I would have said yes if that had happened to me. Well, I've got one more for you, and it's from Ruth chapter 3. And this is when Ruth proposes to Boaz. And let me tell you, this is an interesting one. If we had an internet back then, this would have made the internet of the 25 weirdest proposals. And so here we go. We're going to look at Ruth chapter 3 today. And if you want to, you can open up the bulletin. In there is a teaching sheet. You can follow along with an outline of the message. And so before we get to chapter 3, though, let me give you just a little review of what's happened in chapter 1 and 2. So in chapter 1, we learn that there's been a famine in Bethlehem. And the famine causes one family, not the other families, so one family, to leave Bethlehem and to go to Moab of all places. As you remember, Moab was a place that was not in good terms with Israel, that was full of pagan worshipers that did child sacrifices. Not a good place to bring your family to if you want them to continue following God. And so this family goes there. And they get food, but then the dad dies. And so we have two children now. They're of marriage age. And so not Israelite women. They marry Moabite women. And so then we have Orpah and Ruth married to the children. And but then the sons die as well. And now we have Naomi, the mother-in-law, with two foreign daughters-in-law. And she's like, I am getting out of this place. I'm going home. She goes home. She convinces Orpah to stay in Moab, but Ruth continues with her home. She says, your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Right there, as a foreign pagan woman, she's declaring that she is following God. She's no longer pagan anymore. She is a God follower. She is a person, as we'll see, that is a godly woman, that is a worthy woman. They make it to Bethlehem, and there's a stir. There's a stir because Naomi left 10 years prior full of life and family and comes back with a strange daughter-in-law and no one else. And then she's bitter, she's angry, and she's poor and destitute. That brings us to chapter 2, where Ruth says, hey, I can't just sit around and wait for us to starve to death. So I'm going to go out to the Israelite welfare system where I can glean and get some of the grain that's left behind for me. And there she meets Boaz. Boaz, and he turns out to be a really nice guy, a godly man, he's a wealthy man, and he is very kind to Ruth. He shows her all sorts of really, what I would say, even interest in her, and gives her all sorts of stuff, and then she goes home that first day and tells Naomi, and Naomi's like, oh, he is one of the redeemers, one of the people in charge of rescuing that family should it come to that point. And that brings us to the end of chapter 2, where it says that Naomi gleaned for the rest of that harvest season. So we get to now chapter 3, and we learn that Boaz has not made any other moves on Ruth. And so the end of the harvest is coming. That time is done, and Naomi's getting nervous. Naomi thought likely that, Boaz is going to do something, but now Boaz has not. So what's going to happen? So Naomi comes up with this amazing, not so good plan. Now think about this. Their lives, Naomi's life and Ruth's life, depend really on her marrying again. They are poor, destitute women. They have no way of making a living other than at the mercy of other people. And so if they want to survive, if they want to really thrive, then she or one of them must marry. So Naomi's like, all right, Ruth, this is what you need to do. And so let's go ahead and look at verse 1. What we're going to do this morning is I'm going to walk us through the 18 verses, explain what everything means. And then once we get to the end, I'll talk about how this applies to our lives today. So in verse 1, then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to Ruth, my daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative, with whose young women you were? So what she's saying there, seek rest is really a Hebrew slang for get married. She's saying, as the in a society where it was common to have arranged marriages, she's the parent now of Ruth, and so she's saying, "Hey, it is time for me to hook you up with someone. It is time for me to arrange a marriage for you, and Boaz would be the perfect man for you." She says, and so she comes up with a plan. Let's look at the next part. She says, "See, he is winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor." Everyone understand what that means there, winnowing barley? Okay, and neither did I, for those of you who are not farmers here. So go ahead and, Adam, roll that video. And while he's putting that up there, this just gives you a little more modern idea of winnowing barley. What it is putting the whole grain down through some wind, and it blows away the chaff, but the grain falls down. And so the grain is heavier, and it's basically a way of separating the two. All right, Adam, you can go ahead and stop that. And that is what they were doing, but obviously back then they didn't have strong fans. They only had little portable battery-powered fans back then. No, what they would do is they would usually have this community-type winnowing floor or threshing floor up on a hill somewhere where it was more windy. And they would, all the farmers, all the people that would need it, would sort of rent it out for the night, and they would go and do the winnowing. They would do the separating, but instead of blowing it in a fan, they would sort of throw it up in the air, and the wind would blow the chaff away, but the grain would fall down. And so that's where Boaz is that night. And Naomi's saying he's going to be there. He's working on his barley tonight. And then in verse 3, she says, wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he goes, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all that you say I will do. All right, so those of you who are familiar with the story of Ruth likely are just sort of assuming that all of this is pretty normal, and that all of this is just the way that you would propose to a man back then. But I'm going to tell you, I'm going to explain a little bit about this. And I don't think that this was the greatest plan. I don't think so. So the plan begins with washing, anointing, and putting on a cloak. A better translation of that might be to get dressed in your best clothes. The NASB, the NIV has get dressed in your best clothes or something along those lines. And so in other words, not only does she need to smell good, and not only does she need to look good, but really it's what she's implying there is to take off your mourning clothes from mourning the loss of your husband. And now put on your regular clothes or your best clothes, in essence saying, I am now open for suitors. So she's putting that on. And then she's to go down to the threshing floor and not reveal herself. She's to sort of hide out in the background like a ninja and just sort of watch and observe. And then she's to wait until he eats and drinks, so he's in a good mood. And then she's to watch where he goes. Naomi's probably like, all right, make sure you don't do this to the wrong man. Watch where he goes. I mean, that alone should give you an idea about what kind of messed up plan this is when you have to make sure the man that's lying down is the right man you're looking for. And then go and uncover his feet and lie down. So that word for feet there in Hebrew can refer to feet, but it usually also refers to not just the feet, but the whole leg, really the whole lower part of the body. And so what she's suggesting is not just, uncover just the sock area, but to uncover that whole bottom half of the sheet and then to lie down next to him. Not likely lie down at just on his feet, but to really lie down against him or lie down with him. Now, in full disclosure, if any of you are starting to get a little uncomfortable here in church this morning, this language that she's using can also refer to intercourse with a man. Just even in other parts of the Old Testament, that same language is used with it. But clearly, as we get through this passage, we'll see that Ruth is not the intentions of Naomi. That is not the intentions of Ruth. And Boaz clearly does not have that in mind either. And I'll talk about that in a little bit. But as you think about some of the language that's being used, this is very provocative language that she's suggesting. And so back to the plan, though, and then she said, then Naomi concludes with, then he will tell you what to do. Then he will tell you what to do. All right. Again, I've said, I think that this is not the greatest plan. And let me explain. We're now thousands of years later. And how many of you would tell your daughters to do something like that? That back then was a much more modest society. Now, it was sinful back then. There was a lot of ungodliness going on. But in general, it was a much more modest society back then. And even now, 3,000 years later, none of us would tell our daughters that the way to get married is, all right, if you want to get married, I want you to, the boy that you're interested in, follow him on the camping trip. And then when he, but don't reveal yourself. And then when he lays down on the floor in a sleeping bag, make sure you know it's him. And then go and in the middle of the night, uncover his feet. And then lay down, whether it's translated on his feet or next to him, fine. You can have his feet. But lay down somewhere in his body area. And then when he wakes up, and sees this woman next to him, and she asks, and whatever he says, and then the advice is, do what he tells you to do. Really? Really? Is that the advice that you want to give your daughter? Is that the advice? Do what he tells you to do? I listened to other pastors this week as I listened to other, other sermons on Ruth 3. And I heard a number of them tried to explain this away as this was like a custom to go and to lay at the feet and all this. And, and, And yeah, you know, there may have been some customs of laying at feet, but nowhere do I see in the Bible that it's customary to sneak up on a man in the middle of the night and lay down next to him and propose marriage to him at that time. No, no. This is a risque plan. It's a risque plan. So I'm going on record saying that I do not approve of Naomi's plan. Now, we know it works. It works. Good comes out of it. But so much more could have gone wrong. And I'll talk about that in just a little bit. So let's go now to verse 6. So she went down to the threshing floor, as we saw in the video, and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk, and his heart was merry, he went and lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And so Boaz is in a good mood. You know, we had 10 years of famine, or something about 10 years of famine. And so Boaz, likely, this is one of his first good crops. He is doing well. He's happy. He's at the end of the season where there's a lot of hard work. And he's just looking at all this, you know, all this food, but all this money that he is going to be bringing in. And on top of that, he's had a good meal and he's had a good bottle of grape juice, a good bottle of grape juice that's made him very happy. That's the Baptist translation there. And actually, it doesn't say what he's had to drink. It doesn't say, though, that he's drunk. So we don't know, but all we know is that whatever he had to drink made him happy. Verse 7. And then she came softly and uncovered his feet, likely legs, and lay down. And at midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman laying at his feet. Literally, there could be translated, and here a woman was lying beside him. So this is a pivotal part of the story right here. A lot of things could go wrong right at this minute, right at this moment. Boaz could have turned over and screamed. I know if I had turned over and seen a strange person sleeping next to me, that's what I would have done. I would not have said, as we'll see, who are you? I would have been like, ah! Boaz, if he didn't scream, could have thought that she was a prostitute. Boaz could have, when he gets the proposal, could have scoffed at the proposal because she is a foreign Moabite slave girl, like basically a servant girl, poor and destitute and widowed, married already previously. And he is a wealthy Israelite businessman. Ruth is not the ideal woman that Boaz would likely be looking for. Or Boaz could have just sent her away from this very bold move of proposing to her. Let's see what happens. So in verse 9, "Who are you?" he said. And she answered, "I am Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant." Again, right there is language that can be interpreted either way. It could be interpreted sexually, or it could be interpreted in a good way as well. So spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. So this is the big proposal moment. Ruth is proposing to Boaz. It starts with Boaz waking up, seeing her. Who are you? Ruth says, you know, "I am your servant." That word servant there is interesting because in chapter 2, Ruth introduces her as a servant, but in chapter 2, she uses a word for servant that refers to her more as like a like at the bottom of the ladder type, like slave servant in chapter 2. But here in chapter 3, the word for servant that she uses is a word that is like a maid servant. It's of equal worth, of equal value, and oh, by the way, it's a type of person that he could marry. He wouldn't marry a slave servant. He would marry a maid servant. And so even just with using that word would have sent off all sorts of either warning bells or happy bells inside of Boaz. And then she says to spread your wings. Spread your wings. Again, could be interpreted, eh, or ooh. And It's essentially asking in the good way, saying, be my protector. You know, come and take me, take my, you know, take care of me. That same language is used in chapter 2, when speaking of how she put her life under God's wings. When Boaz says that she put her life under God's wings and that God is blessing her because of that. And so now Ruth is saying, hey, I'm putting my life under your wings. Or will you do that? Essentially, she's saying, marry me. That's what she's saying. We'll see in a moment that Boaz clearly understands that it's on the noble side of things, not on the risque kind of things, side of things. So let's see how he responds. This is, you know, if we're in the romantic comedy movies, this is the big moment that we're all waiting for, the big I do moment. And he said, may your daughter, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, and that you have not gone after the young men, whether poor or rich. And so Boaz begins by blessing her, just as when he greeted the fellow workers in chapter 2 by blessing them. He is just blessing people all over the place. That's the kind of man he is. But it's interesting. He uses the word when he blesses them. He speaks of her kindness. She's saying, he says, you have made this last kindness greater than your first. And that word kindness that he uses there is the word hesed, or if you like the literal, it's like hesed. And just go ahead and if you want to circle that word kindness in your Bibles, we're going to come back to that. And so what kind of kindness did Ruth show? Well, first of all, she showed kindness to stick with Naomi. Naomi was this destitute widow heading back to a land that was not Ruth's own land. And Ruth stuck with her and helped her and supported her and went gleaning for her and shared her doggy bag of food when she was given lots of food. She's been very kind to Naomi. And Boaz, though, sees the proposal as an even greater kindness. Clearly, we don't know what it is, but clearly Ruth had something going for her. Something was going for her. She must have, I don't know, been really good looking or whatever the men were looking for back in that time. She was appealing because Boaz thought that she could have gotten any man that she wanted, young or old. It's sort of like, that stereotypical joke where you see this beautiful supermodel with this ugly guy, and you're like, he must be rich. He must be rich. People say that about my wife and I all the time, and I'm like, oh, you have got it. Yeah, you're in for a surprise there. But Boaz sees himself as this really unworthy guy for whatever reason, likely because he's a lot older than she is. But he does not see himself as the main person that Ruth would be attracted to or would go after. And yet Ruth does. And Boaz says that is an act of kindness toward him. So anyways, he didn't say yes, but it's a good start at least. Let's look at verse 11. And now, my daughter, Boaz says, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you're a worthy woman. And what I think he's talking about there is not really about the proposal part, but probably about the odd circumstances of her appearing at his bedside, really, in the middle of the night. And he's saying, don't worry, don't fear. You know, I'm not going to say anything about this. I know that you're a worthy woman. And so my friends know that you're a worthy woman. I'm not thinking you're up to anything bad here. But also, she doesn't need to fear about the proposal because, as we'll see in verse 12, he's going to work it out. Verse 12 says, and now, it is true that I'm a redeemer. Yet there is a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. But if he is not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So he's saying, I'm interested. I will redeem you, but there's another guy that has first dibs on you right now. And so I need to go and talk to him. And Ruth, don't worry. You don't know who you will marry, but you're going to be marrying someone. And so, yes, I can imagine Ruth saying, well, I guess good. Yeah, I'm going to have a husband, but I don't know who it is. So Boaz is saying that if this guy will not marry her, then he will. Let's look at verse 14. So she lay at his feet until morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said to her, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you're wearing and hold it out. And so she held it out, and he measured 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Now, we don't know what that measure is. So we don't know if it's 6 what, 6, you know, what, 6 something. And so most likely, though, it's referring to a seah of barley, and that would be 6 of them would be about 60 to 100 pounds of barley. Interestingly, if it is that, it's about twice as much as what he gave her in chapter 2. And so he's saying, here you go. I am going to bless you. I'm going to give you double what I gave you before, just to show my intentions to take home to Naomi. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? Literally, she's saying, who are you, my daughter? Asking, hey, you know, are you a missus now? Are you engaged? And then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today. That's the end of the chapter right there. So just as Ruth and Naomi have to wait to find out what happens, we're now going to have to wait until next week to find out what happens as well. But before we move any further along, I want to now talk about what this means for us. What does this mean for me? You all may be thinking, all right, that's a nice story, but I'm not planning to propose to anyone anytime soon. So I can learn from Naomi not to propose like that. But what else does it mean for me today? And I want to say that while this is a proposal story, the application goes beyond proposals. The application goes beyond proposals, because in this chapter, we've seen several important themes that I want to bring up now. And so I want to give 3 themes that we can take away from this chapter that we can apply to our lives. And the first is this: integrity matters. Integrity matters. Now, as I've already said, I don't think Naomi's advice was the best. I think a lot could have gone wrong. They were both in very tempting situations, but in the end, it worked out. It worked out. Now, why is it? Why did it work out? And the answer is because they both had integrity. They both had integrity. Both Ruth and Boaz had an enormous amount of integrity. And because of that, they were able to turn a bad situation into a good one, or into a godly one. See, here's the reality for all of us. All of our lives are filled with tempting, messy situations. And if you want to make an impact for the kingdom of God, and I hope that all of you do, then you must be a person of integrity. Now, I define integrity in this way. This is sort of like the Kyle definition here. I define it as acting uprightly when no one is looking. Acting uprightly when no one is looking. It's what you do even when it seems like you could get away doing something else. Integrity is not how you act on a Sunday morning in church. Integrity is how you treat your kids or your spouse at home. Integrity is how you do your taxes. Integrity is how you act on a business trip when you're all alone. It's what you do when no other eyes are on you. Boaz could have easily have taken advantage of Ruth during this situation. She put herself in a risky situation here. In Hosea chapter 9, in fact, Israel is reprimanded because of paying for prostitutes on the threshing floor. And so the threshing floor was not this pure place where just godliness took place. It was a place of temptation. It was a place where things could have gone wrong. And likewise, though, Ruth could have easily have tried to seduce Boaz. I mean, here we have an older man with a younger woman off on their own. And if Ruth was like, I need to get him to like me. I need to get him to marry me. And so I'm going to do whatever it takes. Ruth could have gone a lot further than she did. But neither did that. It's because they had integrity. Both sought to act in an upright, in a godly way. And here's the beauty of this. When they acted with integrity, they were declaring that God was in control and would provide. Not that they would provide, but that God would provide. You see, when we act with integrity, we're saying, God, you do it, not me. Ruth could have said, I'm going to sleep my way into the marriage. But instead, she said, I will act righteously and I will let God work out my marriage. Let me talk to a couple different groups in here this morning. First of all, let me talk to the young women here. There's going to come a time where you have this guy that you like or you have this boyfriend. And you may be tempted to give more than you want in order to make him like you. And in those moments, I want to challenge you to act with integrity. To act with integrity. And when you do that, you are declaring that God will lead you to the right person, not yourself. Businessmen, businesswomen, there's going to come a time when you feel like in order to make a profit, you have to cheat in order to get ahead or to make enough money. And I want to challenge you to be people of integrity. And when you do that, what you're saying is that you're declaring that God will provide my needs. Husbands, wives, there may come a time when one of you feel like the other is not meeting your needs. There may come a time when you feel like that person doesn't meet my needs, so I'm going to have to go out and find someone else that will meet my needs. And I want to challenge you to be people of integrity. And when you do that, what you're saying, what you're declaring is that God is in charge of your life and marriage and that he will provide for all your needs, for all your desires. Now, I could go on. I could literally look at whatever life stage you're in and say, do this and this and this and these temptations are going to come up. And I challenge all of you. Whether you're a retired person, whether you're a young parent, whether you're a student, no matter what, live with integrity. Live with integrity. Let's look at the second theme that comes up here. It's this. As we follow God, we can have confidence that he will correct our path when we make mistakes. Now, I've already said that we live in a messy, tempting world. And to complicate things, we are messy, imperfect people. And at times, we even make mistakes. At times, we mess up. And so following God during these times can be difficult, can't it? I remember there's been times as I go through life where, you know, I've been at a fork in the road, choosing this path or this path, and I don't know which way to go. And I'm thinking, God, will you just come and audibly speak to me? Because I don't know what to do. Or to make matters worse, I think, is God leading me this way? Or is it just my own desires leading me this way? Or both ways seem right. And you just don't know what to do. But the story of Ruth shows us that as we follow God, we don't have to stress about making the wrong decision because God is sovereign. He is sovereign and he will accomplish his plans no matter what. As I said, Naomi's advice was not the best, and there were probably ways of doing things better. But Ruth acted with integrity. Boaz acted with integrity. And so even though Ruth was following bad advice, she was godly throughout, and so God worked in the situation. So in other words, God accomplished what he wanted to accomplish in spite of Naomi's advice, not because of it. Because that's what God does. He is in control. And that should be an encouragement to all of us that we should not be paralyzed with indecision, thinking, I don't know what to do. What we should do is simply do the best we can in a godly way and trust that God will direct us as needed. Now, I'm not saying that we should be lazy or that we should be sinful. I'm saying that we should act with integrity, but that we should act and not just do anything. But as we do that, trust that God will direct our path. Now, I don't have time for the whole story, but if you want an example of this, you can turn later on to Acts chapter 16, verses 6 through 10. And you can see that Paul was in the same situation. He didn't know which way to go. So he went one way, and then the Holy Spirit stopped him and directed him another way. And the Holy Spirit will do the same in our lives today, but we must act with integrity, must act in a godly way. Let me close with our third point, the third theme here, and it's God's hesed, God's hesed. One of the words that comes up multiple times in Ruth, as I already said, is the word hesed. And as I've already said, it's a word that means kindness, but really it's a bigger word than that. It's translated sometimes steadfast love. It's a big word because it means a lot of different things. It could mean kindness, love, loyalty, mercy, grace, compassion. It's all these things put together and mixed up into one word. Paul Miller writes that hesed is one-way love, that your response to the other person is entirely independent of how that person has treated you. Hesed is stubborn love. In Ruth 1:8, the daughter-in-law shows hesed to her foreign family. And even when the family dies, she shows hesed by sticking with her mother-in-law, as talked about in 3:10. In Ruth 2:20, Boaz shows hesed to Ruth by showing kindness, by giving her things. You know, all of these are little pictures of hesed, of what hesed means. But here's what I want you to see, that just as in Ruth, we have little pictures of it. It is fully shown in Jesus. God's hesed or hesed is fully shown in what Jesus has done for us. Jesus stubbornly and sacrificially loved us. Not based on anything that we did for him, but simply because he chose to love us. And even when we figuratively spit in his face or walk away from him, he still has hesed for you. And so this has big implications in our lives, because even when there's times when we walk away from him, even when we do things where we think that God would never want me back, he has stubborn hesed for you. And so will you turn back to him today? Or for those that have never turned to him in the first place, I want to say that no matter what you've done, he has hesed for you. So turn to him today. And it simply begins by believing that he's Lord and receiving him in your life, by following him as Lord. And when you do that, it says that his steadfast love, his hesed there, is there for you. Will you do that this morning? And will you walk out of here with assurance, knowing that no matter what you do, God's hesed is there for you? Let's pray.